This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. It's the news roundup. The United States now leads the world in the number of coronavirus cases. More than 81,000 people are infected that we know about, and at least 1,000 people have died in this country. We are on social distancing here at 1A, so joining me remotely to talk about what the federal government and state governments are doing to combat the pandemic, we have Julie Pace. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Julie, always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me today.
David Lightman is here. He's national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. David, good to talk to you over the line.
And thanks for having me.
And Juana Summers is here, political reporter with NPR, focusing on demographics and culture. Juana, as always, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Julie, 3.3 million people filed for unemployment benefits this past week. And this week, the Senate passed a $2 trillion economic relief bill. The House is supposed to take that up today. Before we get to this record-busting legislation, we'll talk about some of the details. What's the timeline look like? When do we expect this to finally hit the president's desk?
Well, that depends on when the House actually passes this. They do want to move quickly. There are some procedural shenanigans going on as they try to do that. But this is really something that you sense real urgency around in both parties and certainly at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. The president would like to certainly get this done by Friday evening. If it has to slip into Saturday, that's a possibility at this point. But I think you're going to see this, you know, no later than this weekend.
David, there have been lawmakers scrambling. They're out of town, and there have been lawmakers scrambling to fly back to Washington, even at a time of social distancing, in case they're needed.
Yeah, this has been, needless to say, unique in the history of our country. Now, the Senate vote was 96-0, but the House, they're concerned they won't get the 216 needed for a quorum, which means they have to go with a voice vote. But there are people who would like to have a recorded vote. So it's a logistical mess. One way or the other, I agree with Julie, they'll probably get this done Friday night.
So, Juana, so many provisions in this bill. We could spend a week of shows going through all of them, but the big sort of way the pizza's divided up here, billions of dollars for everyday Americans, checks will go out, about $500 billion directly for corporations. There's aid for states, aid for hospitals, aid for public health agencies, and the rest. I want to focus on the checks that Americans are supposed to get. I guess we have final language now. Who gets money in this package?
There are some income caps that are on that money that people are going to be getting. We're talking about, broadly speaking, these are $1,200 checks that are going to come to people that are be coming out in the next few weeks to Americans. According to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, those who are married and filing joint tax returns could get up to $2,400. And from my understanding, these payments are going to be things that are sent via direct deposit to Americans who have provided the IRS with their bank account information. Other folks will see them mailed. These are one-time payments for now, though lawmakers have told us that in the future there could be other packages negotiated that would mean there would be more payments coming. But those are kind of the broad contours of what we're likely to see.
So, Juana, there's a problem here, though, that came up this week. You mentioned if you have direct deposit information on file with the IRS. Millions of people don't. Millions of people don't even have bank accounts. And we got news this week that for those people, this money could take months. Somebody said 4 months. That's not going to do in a situation like this.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of concern around that. As I've been talking to folks just in the context of my reporting on other things and asking them how they're doing, a lot of people that we know who work in some of these industries, they don't have jobs today. They are trying to figure out how to feed their families, how to make rent or pay their mortgages. So I do think there is a concern that this aid may not come fast enough for many people across the country.
David, this is a question from Dale that you may be able to field. Is it true that the bill contains a tax provision aimed at aiding rich property developers? I think Dale might be referring obliquely to President Trump. But what does the bill say about aid that's available to people in real estate?
Yeah, there's a number of tax cuts in there. I don't know specifically about that. I do know that part of the bill bars the president, vice president, and I believe top executive branch officials from using that $500 billion corporate fund at all. To go back to what Juana was saying, though, with the checks, if I can throw this in,
please.
One of the big questions we keep getting is from retirees who say, I'm getting Social Security or disability. That's my income, that plus my savings. Do I get a check? And the answer is yes, you will, as long as you qualify within those income limits. So that's probably the number one. The other question we get is this. The checks are based on 2019 income if you filed your tax return already. If you haven't, it's based on 2018 income. But what if you were laid off last week? Well, that's something everybody's still trying to sort out. Of course, if you're laid off, there are other programs that could benefit you. But stay tuned.
Some of this is a moving target. There was a lot of impatience for this bill to get done, and rightfully so. It actually is amazing how fast Congress got it done, and some of it's a little bit slipshod. I think that that's just a reality that we're still going to be dealing with some of the details as we go forward. David, let me stay with you just for one more second. Talk about the unemployment benefits that are in this package.
Yeah, right now, or at least until this bill passes, people in most states can qualify for up to 26 weeks of benefits, and the states pay those benefits. The federal government offers money to administer it. In California, for example, the average benefit is something like $338 up to a maximum of $450. On top of that, people will also be able to get $600 a week for 4 months, the thinking being April, May, June, July. So in California, for example, if you're getting the maximum $450, you could get as much as $1,050 a week if you qualify. The problem, of course, is these systems are overwhelmed. In California, it's going to take, the estimate is, at least 3 weeks to go through initial claims. But there will be, in certain instances, as much as $1,000 a week available.
So the president is hoping to sign this bill certainly before the weekend is out. Now, meanwhile, the president told Fox News this week and told the country several times that he wants the United States to start to get back to normal in just a little over 2 weeks.
I'd love to have it open by Easter. Okay, I would
to
have it open by Easter. I will tell you that right now. I would love to have that. It's such an important day for other reasons, but I'll make it an important day for this too. I would love to have the country opened up and just raring to go by Easter.
Now, Julie, public health experts have been pushing back, spending their time pushing back on what the president's been saying. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, he told CNN, the virus sets the timeline. You don't set the timeline. Julie, what is the president's aim here?
The president has a couple of things that he's trying to do here. One, you know, he's really trying to offer some reassurances to the markets, the financial markets. He is trying to reassure business leaders, many of whom he is talking to directly right now, who are really worried, yes, that this is a public health crisis, but that also this is rapidly turning into an economic crisis that could outlast the public health issues here. But there's a reality that we are all seeing in front of us. Almost no matter where you live right now, you are starting to see some level of increase in the number of infections. And we're hearing, yes, from public health officials, but also from governors and Republican and Democratic governors, both parties. People like Larry Hogan in Maryland, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, DeWine in Ohio, people who are saying the situation on the ground simply does not match the rhetoric that we're hearing from the White House. The idea that the economy will essentially be open, as the president says, by Easter just is impossible to imagine in states, in cities where you see the infection rate really on the rise, and you see all of the guidance from all of the countries who have dealt with this before us, all of the guidance suggests that the only way to really start bringing down the infection rate, to start flattening that curve, as we hear from officials a lot, is to do social distancing, is to keep people physically away from each other. And you can't do that if you have restaurants opening, if you open schools, if you have the economy, as Trump says, opening up. So I think over the next couple of days, you're going to see some tension between what the president wants to do and what the states are actually willing to do here.
And you continue to see the president's public health spokespersons and advisors spending their time and energy pushing back on what he's telling the public in the news networks. But Julie, what can the president actually do here. Let's say we get to Easter. Maybe he could order the CDC to alter their social distancing guidelines, but he can't order a governor to open restaurants or end a lockdown.
Right. I think this is a great point in terms of what the president's actual powers are in this situation. You know, this is a state and local decision when you talk about reopening businesses. And if the states are not willing to follow that guidance that the president is giving them, then we will see the economy essentially stay in shutdown mode. But I do think the president of the United States is a very powerful figure in all of this. He has the biggest megaphone of anybody in the country. And if average Americans, particularly Trump supporters, are hearing him say, hey, wait a minute, let's get back out there. We've got to keep going. This is not a country that goes on lockdown. You could see some of these social distancing measures that public health officials are so focused on really starting to break down. If you have people who are out in, you know, crowded, you know, parks and crowded areas, if they're spending time with family, with neighbors, you could see the virus start to spread faster, even if a lot of businesses remain shuttered.
One of the president's jobs is to cheerlead the economy, but there's a different reality here. You cannot cheerlead a virus. You cannot publicly manage a virus in terms of messaging, and you can't spin a virus, something that Americans are going to have to be thinking about in the days and weeks to come. More on the Friday News Roundup coming up. Julie Pace is with us from the AP, David Lightman from McClatchy, and Juana Summers with NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
The coronavirus pandemic is changing everything really fast. So we have created a podcast where you can hear conversations and stories from NPR journalists who are covering the pandemic, the public health fight against it, and how the world is coping. I'm your host, Kelly McEvers. Listen and subscribe to Coronavirus Daily from NPR.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup. And there's one story that's in the headlines across America. We're talking about coronavirus with Julie Pace. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. David Lightman is National Political Correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. And Juana Summers, Political Reporter with NPR, focusing on demographics and culture. David Lightman, Andy has a question that I think maybe is for you. Andy says, my friend receives SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, for a disability, therefore does not file taxes. Will he receive the $1,200 that Juana was talking about?
You know, SSI, I think, may fall into a separate category. If you do not file taxes, if you get a certain government form that talks about your income, you can qualify. Here's what I would do. Call your congressman or senator's office because the unemployment offices are overwhelmed right now. You can't get through. And I find when I want to know something about this bill or how the system works, best bet is to call the offices of the senators or congressmen.
Yeah, they should know the most at this point. As we said before, this bill was, in congressional terms, was thrown together at lightning speed. So they may be the only ones who know the answers to these questions right now.
Very helpful.
Yeah, thank you, David. And I want to shift us back to the White House. We were talking about the president's messaging in terms of the economy, his desire to get things moving by Easter. And Bailey tweets, I stopped listening to the White House press briefings days ago. The misinformation and Trump praise doesn't help anyone from those briefings. And Juana, the networks are starting to struggle with how to cover some of these briefings. They're daily briefings of the coronavirus task force. Different news outlets are starting to make different decisions about how they cover these things.
Yeah, that's right. I think there is something of a delicate dance of you have the president, the vice president, and the health officials who are often assembled with him who are coming out and giving the public information. The challenge of that, of course, is that we're often unable to fact check in real time what the president is saying, the advice that he's giving when he's talking about potentially opening up, as we discussed earlier, things by Easter, perhaps, and that does not seem to jive with the recommendations of some of the health officials assembled behind him. So I do think that everyone's kind of figuring out the best way to handle that. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm certainly not a person who's in a position to decide what the right answer is there, but there's certainly news organizations are certainly doing a lot of work to try to figure that out.
Well, our colleagues at KUOW Seattle, an NPR member station, people mistake it for NPR. It is not NPR. It's an NPR member station, has decided not to carry these briefings live anymore. They say if there's news, we will get it and process it and report on it for you. They feel like there is too much misinformation in these briefings coming, especially from the president. Julie, you spent a long time, a lot of time in that briefing room in the West Wing, in the White House. How do you view, you know, some of the cable networks now are cutting in and out of these briefings. They're not taking them wall to wall. Some networks are taking them wall to wall. You have spent a career dealing with information coming from the mouth of the president. How do you view this this dilemma?
It is a dilemma. I think that's the right way to put it. There are a couple challenges here. You know, on the one hand, you do have very real information that is coming from some of the officials that are taking part in the briefings. This is where we are learning about new CDC guidelines for social distancing. This is where we're learning about the number of ventilators that are getting to New York City. This is where we're learning about what officials make about the spread of this virus from the test results that we're getting in. So on the one hand, you know, this is really important information for Americans who are scared and anxious and want to know what's happening here. On the other hand, you have this second piece of these briefings, which is just so disconnected from the reality on the ground. You know, a lot of happy talk, a lot of praise for how the president specifically is handling this situation, and again, it just is such a disconnect from what most Americans are really seeing here. This is where I think the challenge comes. You know, I think that it is a relevant thing for Americans, particularly in an election year, to judge how the president is handling this situation. And one of the storylines for this president may be that he appeared to be disconnected from reality, that he appeared to not be taking this as seriously as other countries were or as his own public health officials were. And how do you try to make people see that piece of it? You know, one of the ways you do it is you show them what's happening in real time, and you show them what he's saying versus what the reality is. And again, the challenge is whether you do it live or whether you try to, you know, splice in fact-checking, sure, whether you try to splice in analysis. But I do think that is a part of this story, and I don't think we should ignore that.
We all of us journalists especially, and many Americans, most Americans, I hope, believe in more information, not less. Let people decide. The dilemma here is that in a public health emergency, misinformation can be deadly, and misinformation coming from the loudest microphone in the land can be especially deadly. So therein lies the dilemma. I should add, by the way, we did single out KUOW in Seattle. They did decide not to take these briefings live any longer. NPR has decided not to take them live as well. Doesn't mean they're not reporting on them. They are. It just means not running them live directly into the ears of listeners all across the country. David, governors in 50 states, plus D.C., Guam, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, meanwhile, have mobilized National Guard units to aid in coronavirus response. I guess every state is different, but do we know what these troops will be doing?
Oh, there's all kinds of things. It's set up tents, set up hospital beds, distribute food, basically contribute to survival, if you will. They're extremely valuable in that regard. Let me also use that to segue into something Julie was saying at the White House, because we have two White House reporters, and they're invaluable in taking national things like how many ventilators or who's in charge or protective equipment, and feeding that and helping the regional reporters we have, because we have papers in Tacoma, Washington, and Olympia and so forth, and of course in California. And what they care most about, of course, is what does it mean to me? I mean, you look at our web pages, they're all local, but that White House element is crucial, because they're the ones who tell us what's going to happen on that national level, including National Guard to some degree. But as you say, it's the governors who have taken the lead in this.
It is. I've said this before on this show, and it remains true. It is easy to forget that there is a presidential election going on. It has absolutely taken a backseat to a lot of the other news. I talked to Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, presidential candidate, on this show yesterday. This is what he said about how coronavirus has changed the dynamics of the Democratic primary.
A number of states, I believe Pennsylvania is the latest, to actually postpone the elections. So you're talking about an election without elections. What does that mean? You know, that's kind of unprecedented. So all I can say is we are, needless to say, the nature of the campaign. I don't do rallies anymore. We don't have our people out knocking on doors. The nature of the campaign has changed very profoundly. We are going, you know, to virtual campaigning. We are doing events almost every single night.
Juana, a lot of Democrats have been sitting around actively fidgeting and wondering when Bernie Sanders is going to concede to Joe Biden. They want it to be early because they remember 2016. Here was Bernie Sanders on this air saying, nope, this race has fundamentally changed and we may be doing it virtually, but I'm staying in.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to understate just how much everything has changed with the campaign. Candidates can't fundraise, they can't knock on doors, they're not holding rallies. The assumptions about the economy have changed. How the public sees President Trump has changed. And what I've heard from folks around Bernie Sanders and from his supporters is that they want to see him stay in this race. One of the things that a number of them have pointed to when I've talked with them is the fact that this is a candidate who, for whom healthcare has been the key focus of his campaign. His support for Medicare for All has been the pillar on which he's built his campaign. And he and former Vice President Biden have two very different ways in which they would want to provide health care to millions of Americans. And there's a contrast there. And they see value in him having these live streams, which are largely focused on coronavirus and how he would respond to it. They see value on him in him continuing to highlight the work that he's doing in the Senate and the floor speech he had a couple days ago, I believe, that went viral. They want to see him stay there. And it seems so, at least so far, his campaign isn't winding down. Organizers sent out messages talking about how they've moved their entire operation online ahead of New York's primary. So the campaign is still happening. It's just happening in living rooms and home offices.
Juana, a couple things from polls this week. A Monmouth University poll showed Joe Biden leading President Trump in the general election matchup. That has been consistent. President Trump, meanwhile, showing what's a pretty clear kind of rally around the flag bump around the coronavirus pandemic. The size of it is very different in different polls. You mentioned that Democrats are reevaluating the dynamics of the election and President Trump's ratings, too.
Absolutely. They're having to take a look at everything. None of us who cover politics, no one who works in politics, has experienced anything quite like this in modern times. So they have to figure out how to kind of fill in the void when you can't do events outside of your basement, when the entire world is essentially focused on one storyline. How can you be effective? And one thing I want to note, this is having a huge effect on the presidential race, but it's also having a really salient effect on all of these campaigns up and down the ballot, all these candidates who are running for office, the entire House, local elections. This is rippling through our election system in a way that I don't think we can fully comprehend yet.
Julie, one big question around this, and I ask you this question acknowledging that there just may be no way to know whether the summer conventions, Democratic National Convention in July, the RNC scheduled for August, whether they will go off at all. And I ask you this knowing that the 2020 Summer Games in Tokyo were just postponed.
It's such a great question, one that is being asked in many newsrooms, including my own. It's really hard to imagine a situation where you, in a couple of months, are throwing hundreds, thousands of people into an arena together. That just seems so impossible at the moment. In talking to, you know, sources in the RNC and the DNC over the last couple of days, it's clear that there is some contingency planning that is going on. It's also clear that they don't want to make any quick decisions because we don't know where we are going to be in the summer. And I think in both parties, they would like to be able to move forward with a convention, even if it looks a little bit different than what we would traditionally see. Maybe instead of having four nights, you have two nights. Maybe you have fewer people inside an arena. Maybe you do outdoor events instead of indoor events. So there's a lot of contingency planning that's going on. But this really applies to the whole campaign. We just don't know. You know, when is the next time we're going to see a Trump rally? When is the next time that Joe Biden is going to be able to get out and interact with voters one-on-one, which has sort of been his strength, that direct communication with people? This has really reshaped, in ways I don't think we can quite predict yet, how candidates will run for office. And as Juana said, that applies not just to the presidential, but down ballot races as well.
So let's go to the states. Let's talk about the governors. We have already stipulated that so much of the action, the actual boots on the ground decisions are being made by governors. And we've gotten a couple of messages from people concerned about the DPA, the Defense Production Act, and how this relates to how states can get resources. Michael says President Trump has signed emergency declarations, but he hasn't actually completed the steps necessary to turn the emergency declarations into money that states can use. The Defense Production Act has been signed, but not invoked. Do states have access to emergency funds yet, David? Michael wants to know.
We're waiting for the House to vote. I think there's something like $1.5 billion the states could tap that have nothing to do with the Emergency Production Act. There's a minimum I think each state can get. But once that bill is signed into law, they will get that aid. There's a number of other provisions in there for states. There's a $3 billion fund to help education programs governors can tap. There's, I can't remember the figure, low-income energy assistance money. Community development block grants, which you don't hear about, but they're kind of vital to communities. This is the money that helps keep rec centers open, social services going, sidewalks being built. In other words, cities, towns can use this money for the most obvious vital services. There's more money in there for that as well. So once that bill is signed, I think you're going to see money flow back to the states pretty quickly.
Juana, what has been this debate over the DPA, the Defense Production Act? Now, this is rarely used, but it gives the president the power to direct industries in a time of national emergency. For instance, just to give one example, we need masks. Hey, company, go make masks. That would be one example. What's the controversy around this now?
Yeah, so from my understanding and from NPR's reporting, this is a law that allows the government to essentially jump to the front of the line to buy up goods and then ship them where they were needed. Some of the governors across the states, including New York's Governor Cuomo, have said that Trump has opened the doors to using this and now it's time to do that. But the president has given some conflicting answers on his use of the law. At times, he said that he was indeed using the law to force companies or make them take action. But at other times, the administration has said that the president is not using the law to push the productions of things like ventilators and masks. So it's not really clear to me, at least right now, how that's being used. And that seems to be where the debate is that we're hearing some mixed messages.
Aaron writes this, Julie, this is a good question. Why are states having to compete against each other in bidding wars for supplies? Shouldn't a federal agency be coordinating that? In this situation, it's crazy that they're competing rather than cooperating.
And we are starting to hear that from people like Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York. We heard it actually come up a little bit in the White House briefing yesterday from Deborah Birx. And I think what you're starting to see is some discussion about whether you could have equipment that is sitting in areas that are not quite as hard hit at the moment, moving into states and cities that are. So, you know, New York City right now is really the epicenter of this pandemic in the United States. Could you have materials moving from other states that don't have as high of a caseload into New York and then coming out of New York when the situation there gets more under control into places where new cases start to spring up? one of the challenges of that is that, you know, we live in a system of government where individual states really do have control over their own resources and really do control their own decision making. And it actually is difficult to have the federal government step in to order states to do something like this. So you're relying in some cases on goodwill between governors and between state officials to kind of work with each other and come up with a plan. But that is the reality of where we are. A lot of this really does rest with the states at the moment.
And is it the case that governors, I mean, governors aren't going on eBay themselves, but their aides are going on the market trying to buy supplies and have found themselves bidding against neighboring states?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely know that there's a lot of communication between the governors right now, and the governors and the federal government. President Trump, Vice President Pence are having a lot of discussions with these governors, and they're picking up a lot of frustration about exactly this point, that some of these governors feel like they are competing against each other. Some of them feel like there really is no mechanism to prioritize hard-hit states versus lower-risk states at the moment.
We'll talk more about the governors and how they are handling the response to coronavirus. We'll also get inside the minds of our reporters, find out what stories they've been watching, how they've been looking at coronavirus behind the headlines. It's the News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
There are scientists out there trying to chart the frontiers of the unknown.
That's right. He has been to some places that no other human being has seen.
What does that feel like? I've been to places you don't know. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. Join me as we journey through talks that take us to places uncharted. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen now.
Let's get back to the news roundup now with Julie Pace from the AP, David Lightman of McClatchy, and Juana Summers with NPR. Juana, let me play you a little bit of sound since we're talking about governors. Here is Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who's been doing a lot of press, a lot of TV, and a lot of work this week.
When we went to war, we didn't say, any company out there want to build a battleship? Who wants to build a battleship? Maybe a couple of you guys could get together and build a battleship. Maybe a couple of you guys could get together and build us some missiles. Maybe, you think. Anybody want to build a plane? You know, we're going to need planes. They're sending planes at us and they're dropping bombs. Anybody want to do that? That's not how you did it. President said it's a war. It is a war. Well, then act like it's a war.
Juana, I have been struck by Andrew Cuomo's stagecraft this past week, holding briefings, you know, sat in front of boxes of supplies, sort of doing real talk on the severity of the pandemic in his state and in New York City, going on cable news all night long, even doing shtick with his brother, who's a CNN host and getting a lot of social media buzz. Andrew Cuomo has really made himself and his state, I think, the center of a lot of what Americans are seeing here.
Yeah, he absolutely has. I've been watching cable news pretty much nonstop, and I've been watching CNN, MSNBC, other networks taking his briefings live at length as he's discussing the challenges there. I think what we just heard from Governor Cuomo really gets at kind of the interesting ways that governors are having to navigate this moment. They've kind of gone back and forth between complimenting the president, confronting the president, knowing that he responds to both of those things, kind of really stepping out and showing some leadership in their states and trying to figure out how to get people what they need. But there's no question that Governor Cuomo's frustrations, his real talk, have been incredibly gripping and incredibly powerful. I live in Maryland, and people here have been talking about his briefings nonstop, even though they have nothing to do with the response in our state.
Yeah. David, there is the question of ventilators, let's just say, in New York. Now, Andrew Cuomo has been on television a lot and in the newspaper saying he needs 30,000 ventilators or more to meet the peak of the curve that's coming in New York. The president got on Fox News and said he doesn't believe that states like New York need 30,000 ventilators. He just doesn't believe it. Virginia asks this, I'd like to know who we can believe. Dr. Deborah Birx says there's absolutely no shortage of ventilators and PPE, personal protective equipment, but nurses in New York City say they're having to improvise, David.
This is a great journalistic question. I mean, we go to the people closest to the situation, which, as you say, are the nurses, the physicians, the public health officials in the states. In Washington state, for example, they're having this problem as well. The entire congressional delegation wrote a very lengthy letter the other day detailing where they're having a problem, their source of the problem, and so forth. So, again, I tend to go with the people on the ground here who are dealing with this day by day.
Some hospitals, David, are considering universal do not resuscitate orders for coronavirus patients whose hearts stop or their breathing stops, regardless of their wishes, as a way to combat an overwhelming situation where there is not enough equipment and enough beds for all the people who are sick.
We've heard that, but boy, you got to remember the Hippocratic Oath. I can't imagine a physician doing that, at least that just goes beyond what you could even think about. I know I've read that too, but I'll believe it when I see it.
I want to make sure we talk about some of the other states and some of the other governors, Julie. Louisiana has seen a spike in cases this week. Governor John Bel Edwards, he gave a striking press conference yesterday pleading with people in his states to comply with his earlier shelter-in-place order. Tony Fauci says Louisiana probably should have acted sooner. What's the situation in Louisiana now?
Yeah, Louisiana is one of those hot spots that I think we're all going to be talking about in a couple of days. We're already seeing a lot of strain on the hospitals in New Orleans and in other parts of the state. And, you know, you have to remember, especially in New Orleans, like, this is a city that is still fairly fragile after Katrina. Even all these years later, it is a city that that is always kind of feeling like it's like one step away from turning into a more negative direction. They're very dependent on tourism. tourism is basically shuttered right now everywhere in the country. But it's more than Louisiana. We're talking about this virus starting to really spread quickly in places like Wayne County in Michigan, Cook County in Illinois. There are several other locations that public health officials are watching. So even though so much of the attention right now in the United States is on New York, I think you're going to start to see hotspots around the country really coming online in the next week or so.
The governor of Mississippi said that Mississippi is never going to be China. It's never going to be North Korea. He's urged Mississippians to pray for an end to the virus. In New York City, NYU is offering early graduation 3 months early for its med students, realizing that they may have to get into action. And in Virginia, in Lynchburg, Virginia, Liberty University, the Christian university founded by Jerry Falwell, is welcoming students back to campus. University President Jerry Falwell Jr. says the school is not reopening, but he went on to say this on CNN.
Liberty has between 1,000 and 2,000 students on a campus built for 15,500, and almost 1,000 of those are international students who have nowhere else to go.
Juana, Liberty University is getting a lot of coverage. Falwell says libraries and academic buildings are open, but the school is actually discouraging students from sitting near each other. What's going on here?
Yeah, that's very different than the response, clearly, that we've seen from a lot of other colleges and universities across the country who have shut their doors. They're moving to virtual learning for students for the remainder of the academic year. They're telling folks to go home. They're telling folks who are on spring break to return and self-quarantine if they've been to a place where they could be in danger of being a carrier of coronavirus, contracting it themselves. I think there's a lot of questions around whether or not this is within the best recommendations of public health, which is called for social distancing, and it is certainly out of the norm for what we've seen other places, particularly as in the state of Virginia, we've seen the governor has closed public schools for the remainder of the year. So I think that there's going to be a lot of scrutiny around this, and of course, a lot of folks were very concerned that we could see a lot of students on this small, tight-knit campus. They could get sick, the students, the folks who are working there and who are going to be on that campus unless they change this decision.
Well, so many of us this week are spending a lot of time at home. So many of us, frankly, are putting the internet and the internet's bandwidth to the test. Companies like Netflix, Xbox, Facebook, Amazon, all having to decide when to throttle their bandwidth because so many millions of us are using those services. We are spending a lot of time on the internet. And we're all also looking for a good laugh, speaking of the internet. I have to say, this week, if you were online, you definitely got a good laugh. I want to highlight this because I just love it so much. NBC Montana's Dion Broxton, he was trying to do a stand-up, a news report, out at the entrance of Yellowstone National Park. And then, out of the corner of his eye, he spotted a herd of bison coming his way.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm not messing with you.
Dion Broxton spotting those bison. He gathered up his gear. He got into his news car and drove off down the road a little bit as Americans watched this video, I think, over and over and over again.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm not messing with you.
Julie, a lot of people saw themselves in our colleague, Dion. They said that that's how they feel when people around them are trying not to social distance.
It did have a social distancing spin on it. I'm not sure I should even admit how many times I watched that video. And I was just sitting here cracking up as you were playing it again. That is really the viral video I feel like we all desperately needed this week.
Oh, it's the greatest.
Thank you to our colleague for that.
Thank you to our colleague, Dion Broxton, Baltimore native. A lot of people saw Dion out there at the entrance to Yellowstone and thought, is he from Baltimore? Turns out, yes, he is from Baltimore. Some people were able to pick it up in that very, very real moment. All right, thank you to our colleague, Dion Broxton, for that. All right, this is the moment in the show where I like to turn to our reporters for just a couple of minutes, ask you how you're looking at the headlines from behind the headlines, what stories you're thinking about, and how you're thinking about them. Juana, let me start with you. What have you been thinking about this week as you go about your coverage?
Yeah, so one of the things I've thought about a lot is just how coronavirus has been affecting all of those candidates down the ballot. We obviously have talked a lot about the presidential race, but I spoke to a couple of folks who are running for Congress about what challenges this made for them. And one of those candidates is Brianna Wu. She's a Democrat. She's running to challenge Congressman Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts. And she told me one of the things that is really hard is something really simple, getting on the ballot. She has a deadline coming up where she and other candidates have to give 2,000 signatures in order to get on the ballot for the September primary. But when you can't knock on doors, you can't canvass, people are staying home, it's really hard to just get that very simple thing of 2,000 signatures. So it's made her campaign and other campaigns have to reassess how they can move forward. Another point she made that I know we've talked about in the context of other campaigns is how difficult it is to fundraise in this environment. We talked on the phone last week, and she told me that she called three different people who had pledged to donate to her campaign. They followed up, and they told her they'd either lost their jobs or weren't sure when their next paycheck was going to come, so they couldn't reach out and do that. So it's an incredibly challenging landscape across politics right now, and all these candidates are trying to figure it out while also doing the mundane things of just trying to keep their families fed and healthy and safe.
David Lightman, how about you? What are you thinking about?
Well, two things. The overarching theme here, what we're trying to do, is write stuff that's meaningful to people. That's why we dig into the unemployment stuff, the cash payments. People have a lot of questions. You saw just on the show and the emails you're getting. Now, we're not a government agency, but anything we can do to cut through and answer this. We did a lengthy Q&A today on SACB.com. Second thing, to give away my trade secrets, I like to go through the entire bill. I learned long ago, even though it's 883 pages, mm-hmm. read the darn thing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what's in there. It also helps your understanding, and it informs the questions I can ask of these members of Congress. Finally, the $500 billion in money to corporations, we're watching that very closely. We don't have details yet, but that's going to be an ongoing concern.
$500 billion in the context of $2 trillion might not sound like a lot. It's an unbelievable number in these times. Julie Pace, how about you?
There are obviously a lot of industries that are going to be hard hit by the economic downturn that we're witnessing. And one of the industries that I'm paying attention to is our own. There's a lot of stress right now on local media in particular, local newspapers, local digital outlets, even local television. Advertising has really just been diminished. And to David's point, you know, the information that we're trying to get to the public is so vital right now, probably more vital than ever. Considering all the tentacles that this story has, and I think there is going to be a lot of layoffs, potentially budget cuts in local media. So I would encourage those of you who find, you know, fair reporting, independent reporting to be really so central to our democracy, particularly in these moments, to really support your local news organizations. They need it now more than ever.
And Julie, I mean, David made the point very clearly that at times like this, it is the details on the ground, in the place, in the hospital or the nursing home that you're talking about, where you find the facts of what's really going on. They don't come from the briefing room at the White House.
They don't. This is what's happening in your own communities, with your schools, with your hospitals, with your local businesses. And it's again, it's your local media that is there to tell those stories. And they really do need your support right now.
I want to thank all my guests on the News Roundup this week. That is Julie Pace, Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Julie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
David Lightman is national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, local papers all over America. David, thank you.
Pleasure. Stay healthy.
Juana Summers, political reporter with NPR, our friend focusing on demographics and culture. Juana, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks. Stay well.
And as always, this show, it's kept on the air thanks to a team of brilliant engineers. They are Al Reynolds, Natalie Uravivkar, Kenny Pirog, Rashad Young, Verenda Silva, Doug Bell, Cliff Gallagher, our own Jake Cherry, and engineering chief Rob Bertrand. We thank them for everything that they're doing, and we thank you for listening and for supporting this public radio station. Well, before we take off, ever since this health crisis kicked in America, you've been sharing with us and with all of our American brothers and sisters some moments of kindness and generosity in your lives. Today's story comes from Debbie in Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
My kids are all homeschooling, and my youngest son's best friend had a birthday on Tuesday. They were all devastated that they couldn't spend the party together that they had planned, but My son decided he wasn't going to let the day go unnoted. We drove over to the house with his violin in tow, and my son stood on the curb and serenaded his best friend with a violin song. It was a beautiful moment, and many tears were shed. We can still come together and celebrate with one another, even if we can't be as close as we want.
Debbie, we love that story. Thank you for sharing it with us. By the way, if your son wants to send us a violin song, we'd love to hear it. We're going to be posting some video on our Twitter feed for people who want to see it. It's just fantastic. You know, what acts of kindness and empathy, solidarity, have you seen in recent days in your community? They can be big ones. They can be tiny ones. They can be coronavirus related. They can just be little stories from your life. Let us know. Tell us your story. 855-236-1212. You can leave us a message on our free app. It's 1A Vox Pop. Again, the number to get your voice on our air, 855-236-1212. All right, before we take a break, I got to hear Dion Broxton one more time. Jake, give it to me.
Oh, no. Oh, no, I'm not messing with you.
those bison trying to violate social distancing. All right, we'll have more news in the international section of the News Roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. It's the international section of our News Roundup. And since there's only one story in the world right now, we're going to break it down region by region. Deaths are sharply up in Spain. Iraq is using its air force to drop information flyers. In Pakistan, Friday prayers have gone ahead largely as normal. President Putin gave Russians a week off to help slow the spread in his country. And with India on lockdown, the BBC reports that an estimated 5 million truck drivers are stranded, unable to get home, and they're sleeping in the backs of their trucks. It'll please you to know that none of my guests are with me, at least in a physical sense, in the studio, but from their respective homes. We're joined by Vivian Salama, correspondent with CNN. Vivian, welcome.
Good to virtually be with you.
Good to virtually be with you as well. Courtney Kuby is here, national security and military reporter for NBC. Courtney, as always, good to talk to you.
Hi, Todd. Thanks so much for having me.
And Hayes Brown is here, deputy world news editor at BuzzFeed News. Hi, Hayes.
Hi, thanks for hypothetically having me.
Having you in a sense. We're all here to have an important chat. It's like so much of America. Look, a lot of people are having their meetings online, on the phone, over text, and over WhatsApp. And so why should we be any different? Let's start in Asia. The BBC now estimates that roughly a quarter of the world's entire population is living under some sort of shelter-in-place order due to coronavirus. That includes more than a billion people in India. Now, for 21 days, no one in India is allowed to leave their homes except to see a doctor or to buy food and medicine. Vivian, India has seen roughly 600 cases, 16 deaths. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the overall population. India clearly is trying to get a very, very early jump and avoid some of the calamity that other countries have seen.
So it's a double-edged sword, because obviously it would be catastrophic if this starts to catch on in India just by regard of its sheer population. 1.4 billion people. For anyone like myself who's been to India, you know that it is crowded in the big cities. It is hard. Social distancing is not the most practical approach to things. It's really difficult to do. And so the Indian government, knowing this, really tried to get ahead of it. But it is obviously going to have a massive economic toll, and they know that as well. Also, just given India's ability to test its healthcare system is probably not equipped to handle. If we're struggling here in the United States, imagine what the situation would be in India if this started to really have a contagion effect. And so the government knew this. And one of the main reasons they've been able to pull this off is because of the fact that they do have this functioning government structure, if you will, that was able to implement this on a widespread level throughout the country. Places like neighboring Pakistan have not been able to do that because you have a dysfunctional government. They've really struggled to enforce this kind of stay-at-home lockdown situation that to the point where doctors are not even going into the into work, but people are going out into the streets. And so every country is having to sort of adapt to its own circumstances, and some are doing better than others. India has had to take drastic measures, but so far it's working.
Well, Courtney, as Vivian mentioned, drastic measures in India, early and drastic, early from the perspective that they don't have a lot of cases yet. But Vivian touched on this. India also has a very shaky economy, and ordering 1.4 billion people to stay home unless they're going to get food or see a doctor does also, I mean, inevitably carry real risks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Viv's absolutely right. You know, one of the reasons that in a country of 1.3 billion people, one of the major reasons that this is even able to have a government that pulls it off is Prime Minister Modi. He's just wildly popular with the people. And I think without him, this would be a really tough call. But, you know, India has so many challenges when you look at this. It's they're only reporting a few hundred cases, but with a population that is so dense and this, you know, overall poor public health system, the reality is there are a lot more cases there than they know about. And if, in fact, they start testing and people start getting sick, that has the potential to be a real catastrophe. So there's a concern that it has already spread much further. One thing that I've been really fascinated by is some of the reporting that's come out of there in the days. It's only been several days now since they began this three-week lockdown. But some of the anomalies, doctors and medical staff are actually being shunned and kicked out of their homes because they had been going in, and there's concern. There's so much fear about people who might have this that they're worried that they might infect other people. They're being kicked out onto the streets, which is, of course, the exact opposite of what we're seeing in so many other countries where first responders, medical professionals are being lauded as these heroes. But in India, it is just such an already fragile economy that the grocery stores, many of the shelves are empty. So even the people who have some money, who aren't among the millions who are out of work, there's a concern that they won't be able to get basic goods. They've cut off a lot of the commerce. You know, you mentioned, Todd, early on that there are trucks that aren't able to drive. There's reports of police harassing people who are driving trucks. That's discouraging companies from actually trying to deliver goods to people. So there's worry about mass starvation among people who don't have any money. And then the people who do have the money won't have any goods they can actually purchase.
Now, Hayes, we mentioned this startling episode in India. It's amazing. 5 million truck drivers now stranded, sleeping in their trucks. It's just one snapshot that gives you a sense of just the enormous breadth of a lockdown like this in a country like India.
It's true. And honestly, the density of India, the fact that there are these communities that are far-flung, that it'll be so difficult, I think, to scale up the testing necessary to make sure that India actually has this under grip. And like I just said, two of my colleagues in India have reported on doctors being assaulted by the police as they were trying to get to their hospital, because both of them were women, both of them were trying to get to the hospital during, you know, curfew hours, and it went viral. So I think that India has just this massive challenge. And Modi has been a strong leader, yes, but there's worries that, you know, as the pandemic grows worse, especially inside of India's borders, that Modi's, you know, nationalist stance could become sort of a hindrance, the way we've started to see in other countries around the world. Also, I mean, one of the things that was fascinating at the beginning of this lockdown was Modi's call for, you know, everyone to come out to their balconies and applaud, to cheer on the healthcare workers. And people did do that in the cities, but a little too well. You saw videos and pictures of people standing extremely close together, including local politicians, which kind of defeats the point mm-hmm. of the social distancing that they're trying to put into place.
And as India gets more and more serious, more draconian about preventing coronavirus, those conflicts, those societal conflicts, surely will start to come into starker relief. We keep our eyes on China, of course, all throughout this pandemic. Now, stores in China appear to be starting to open back up as the number of cases seems to be leveling off there. The country closed its borders to foreign nationals this week in a bid to keep the virus from receding and having a resurgence. And we had this late night tweet from President Trump. He said, "Just finished a very good conversation with President Xi of China, discussed in great detail the coronavirus that is ravaging large parts of our planet. China has been through much and has developed a strong understanding of the virus. We are working closely together. Much respect," says the president of the United States. Vivian, we watch China each week for potential lessons learned as they are ahead of us on the curve by 6 or 8 weeks. What have we learned?
So perhaps the lockdown measures that China took were, in a way, a positive and a beneficial way to stem the spread of this virus. And that's definitely something that we first saw in China, and other countries have followed that model since then. In the beginning, when China did that, a lot of countries were like, you know, astonished that they would take such drastic measures. But as this virus spread and as the world started to learn the severity of it, obviously those measures seemed to make a lot of sense. Of course, we always have to be careful when we're talking about China, because transparency has been a major issue with the government there in terms of numbers and a truthful picture of what's taking place and how they are confronting this. But it does seem to be something that is slowly coming under control. President Xi went to Wuhan a couple of weeks ago, and that was seen as a major victory run for him, because he was able to go and sort of say, you know, we're starting to get a hold of this, and this is something that we're learning how to confront. But also, you know, a lot of concern around the world about how he handled it to begin with. The fact that there were whistleblower doctors that were ignored in the beginning, and some of them suppressed when they tried to flag this early on. President Trump and his own, you know, his administration has been very critical, although measured in recent days, about how China has handled this, both on the issue of transparency. They've described it as the Chinese virus and the Wuhan virus because of how China had confronted this. President Trump himself has kind of stepped away from that rhetoric in the last couple of days, but in general, his administration is not. And so there's lots of criticism toward China because of how it handled it, but also a lot of hope for countries that are now sort of in the thick of it, saying, well, you know, there is hope that we can get through this in a matter of months.
The Olympic Games postponed this week, the 2020 Games in Tokyo postponed for at least 1 year. Now, the Olympics have been canceled before, Courtney, 3 times, but each time because of World War One, and twice during World War II, the games have been canceled. They've never been postponed before. What does this mean for Japan?
Yeah, that's right. So they were twice in the 1940s and then once in 1916. But as you mentioned, Todd, it was because of war, not because of a pandemic outbreak like this. So, you know, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is saying that it's the games will go forward in 2021. They'll still call them the 2020 games, which I find fascinating. President Trump has praised the decision over and over, saying it was the right thing to do. And he said he pledged to go to the games, which I also found fascinating, because he didn't say whether he'd go if he's not reelected, if he's not president anymore, but he said he would go. You know, Japan initially, this unfolded actually pretty quickly over just a matter of a couple of days, where Japan said they were considering it. The IOC, the Olympic Committee, said that they were considering it. And the Japanese government seemed somewhat hesitant at first about pulling out of the games. They've invested hundreds of millions, potentially billions of dollars in preparation for these games. This is an enormous undertaking and potentially economic boom for these countries to get the Olympics. That's why they vie so hard for them in the years leading up to it. But then Canada announced that they weren't going to send a delegation. They were followed by Australia. So it seemed pretty inevitable that they were going to have to cancel the games. The reality is, you know, it's only a couple minutes or a couple of months away before this starts. So the potential to have tens of thousands of people descending on Tokyo in tight quarters, it was too risky of a proposition for them.
Now, part of the, yes, resistance from Japan may have been that they've seen relatively few cases of coronavirus, but the prospect of athletes, spectators, staff, coaches, news media pouring in from around the world, even from places that have been infected, became too much. On Thursday, we spoke to Natasha Hastings. Now, Natasha Hastings is a track and field star on Team USA, gold medalist from 2008. Natasha says that she's trying to make the best of the delay, but it's impossible to plan right now.
We don't have a date. We just have 2021, but when in 2021? So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty that we're now trying to repurpose and find some certainty in, but, you know, there's still a lot of questions that need answers.
That was U.S. Olympian Natasha Hastings. We spoke to her on this program as part of a whole conversation on the Olympics cancellation, and you can find that interview on our website at the1a.org. Hayes Brown, postponing the Olympics means uncertainty all across the board for athletes like Natasha and for prime ministers like Shinzo Abe. The uncertainty around the Olympics, how big of a problem is this for Japan, not only the expense, but having to rally their own country to still be behind the Olympics?
Right. I mean, one of the things that we are forced to talk about every 4 years is just how expensive the Olympic Games are for a country to host, and how much money goes into building this new infrastructure and all of that. So I think that it depends really on how much over budget the Tokyo Games wind up being, because they were already wildly over budget, as you know most Olympic Games are. But the decision to delay was the right call, especially considering the fact that Tokyo itself, there have been relatively few cases of coronavirus in Japan overall. Tokyo, though, saw 40 new cases on Friday. So, and Tokyo's governor has asked people to stay inside if at all possible this weekend, prompting a run on grocery stores. So the country isn't immune to the coronavirus. It's not immune to this pandemic that's spreading right now. So for Japan to finally bite the bullet and say, all right, we cannot have this many people coming into the country in just a few months, was the right call. It remains to be seen, though, whether it hurts Abe politically in the long run.
Yet another institution, a world institution in this case, thankfully not canceled, but postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Let me move us to Europe. A lot of news, a lot of observations on Europe. This morning, we learned that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tested positive for coronavirus. His symptoms are mild, but he's promised to continue to run the country from home. He is isolating in 10 Downing Street. We learned that Prince Charles, the heir to the British throne, is positive for coronavirus. But Spain and Italy have been the hardest hit so far. Italy was the first Western country to deal with a large-scale outbreak, of course, Vivian. It implemented a national lockdown. What have the numbers shown us from Italy, whether they are starting maybe to come through the other end of this wave?
Italy has really struggled and throughout this whole entire crisis. And, you know, the United States had been watching Italy very closely because of the fact that we seem to be on par with a lot of their the patterns of growth and in terms of how this was spreading. And the government has really struggled with it. They are starting to, there have been good days and bad days. It's been a little bit rocky in terms of number of new confirmed cases and deaths, where one day they say, okay, we've had a drop, and then the next day it spikes. And so there's been no real consistent breakthrough like we've seen, for example, with China, where there's been sort of a steady, observable decline. And this is something, you know, a number of factors. And again, it's sort of like what we were talking about with India and Pakistan in terms of, you know, do they have a strong government? Was testing widely available? What is their medical system like, and all of these factors that various countries are very quickly having to confront and grapple with and be realistic about is sort of revisiting whether or not they're equipped to handle this kind of widespread public health crisis. And Italy, unfortunately, was not. You know, between the tourism industry that you have there and people traveling in and out of the country, crowded cities, and as well as these factors that I just listed, this has been something that has been a problem for Italy versus some of its, you know, neighbors in Europe, where some countries have handled it better than others. But now, Italy has been a center of sort of this, the bad news for Europe.
And to the west in Spain, some bad news as well. That country saw its highest single day death toll in the world so far, 738 deaths, Courtney, the highest in the world for one single day. A lot of these deaths occurred in nursing homes, which are particularly vulnerable. But now we look to Spain with all of these challenges that Vivian just mentioned in Italy, now becoming obvious in Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's they had a devastating day. More than 700 people died in one day there this week. Madrid is the hardest hit, but Catalonia is also showing more and more cases. It seems to be another place. And as you mentioned, Todd, many of the victims are in nursing homes there. One thing that I just found astonishing this week was the biggest ice rink in Madrid was converted to an enormous morgue. Hmm. They were so desperate. They have so many bodies that they're taking them to an ice rink to, you know, maintain them. So, you know, one of the problem, another big problem that Spain is going to have in the coming days is that they have thousands of their medical staff who are reporting to be sick. So, you know, we hear so much, especially in the past 48 hours or so, about the overtaxed medical systems, particularly here in New York City and whatnot. But that's a place, Spain is going to be one of the ones that has that as well. Their death toll surpassed China's this week, and they had been on a 15-day lockdown. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has already extended that. It's now going until mid-April. So they're not out of the woods. You know, another thing that I also found amazing this week in Italy, we've been talking so much about the somewhat draconian measures, really, that China instituted early on to try to stop the spread. But Italy has really been considering these amazingly strong penalties for Italians who violate the lockdown rules. Violations that could include fines of thousands of euros and even possible jail time if you violate the quarantine. So, I mean, it's the way that things are changing in these countries and the ways that they're having to deal with it. It's just unbelievable to watch.
Maybe some better news, though, from Germany, where coronavirus death rates are the lowest in Europe. Now, a lot of people attribute this to aggressive testing in Germany. This dates all the way back to February. From then until now, officials speculate that they've tested 120,000 people per week. And that's important because when you test somebody, if they're positive, it enables social distancing. It enables contact tracing. That person is sick. You can trace the others around them who might be infected. On Sunday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel began self-isolating herself after learning that she might have contracted the virus. An early test shows that she was negative. Officials say she'll be tested multiple times just in case. Hayes, Germans are proud and famous for their organization. It seems like it may be paying off in this case.
Yeah, it actually does. I mean, compared to the rest of Europe, Germany is in a really good spot right now, at least partially because they're, you know, federal states have been acting on their own. They acted quickly. They have been moving extremely fast to make sure that any detections of COVID-19 are isolated and put aside. The German death rate right now is hovering around 0.5%, which is the world's lowest, despite the fact that Germany has a high number of cases of coronavirus. So because they're able to find them early. And that's something that you didn't see in the United States. You didn't see that widespread testing. So while, you know, President Trump was talking about wanting to keep those numbers low, Germany has had the opposite approach, which is to find the cases, have the numbers be as high as they need to be, so long as you are actually tracking them and making sure those people can be treated and they are prevented from spreading the virus elsewhere. So it's going to be hard for other countries to replicate that, given the fact that, you know, Germany has an economic advantage on a lot of countries around the world, has an organizational advantage on a lot of countries around the world, and they have a time advantage at this point. They've been testing, like you said, since February. So it's going to be hard for other countries to keep up and to try and match that extremely low death rate.
It's Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News. It's the News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A. Now, not far away in Sweden, also relatively low infection rates, but a very different governmental attitude and different rules. Restrictions for travel have been lax in Sweden. A lot of people are criticizing this response. Public health officials in Sweden refuse to make risk assessments. Schools and businesses remain open. Vivian, why such a drastically different response from Sweden? And I guess the corollary question is, low infection rates now, can they hope to keep those rates low?
Well, they need to hope that, because it is definitely a risky approach. You know, as you say, it hasn't shut its borders. Schools are not closed, and they haven't banned gatherings of fewer than 500 people. People are going skiing in Sweden, and, you know, they're just trying to carry on normal life. And the government has sort of insisted that this is a way to kind of build immunity in terms of, like, you know, the social interaction. And it's an important thing for the psyche and the national psyche. And they believe that this is, you know, a way to confront it, and they can just basically stay like strong like a nation and keep on operating as normal. They have a strong healthcare system that is available to all. And so they believe that they are well equipped to confront this this pandemic. Mm. But at the same time, obviously, it's you're taking a huge risk there. And there's, you know, a number of countries that ignored it early on are now paying the consequences, suffering the consequences.
And we will see. They do have an excellent healthcare system. On the other hand, one thing that we've definitely had proven to us, believing that you're well equipped doesn't impact a virus at all. It behaves exactly the way it wants to, regardless of what you believe about yourself. Now, one famous Swede, climate activist Greta Thunberg, she announced this week that she thinks she may have contracted coronavirus. She made an Instagram post, and she said that she's experiencing symptoms and has chosen to isolate herself. Now, she also explained that in Sweden, you cannot get a COVID-19 test unless you are in urgent medical need. And we got this from Catherine, who said, please discuss reports of deaths from COVID-19 in younger people in the U.S. and in other countries. There are reports of high numbers of people in their 20s to 40s needing hospitalization. Now, Courtney, Greta Thunberg apparently does not need hospitalization, or at least we hope not, but it does point up what Catherine is writing about, which is young people who may be at more risk than we originally suspected.
Yeah, I think there's this widespread misconception that young people can't contract coronavirus. And that's just absolutely untrue. I mean, there are cases of infants in the United States now who've gotten it, and toddlers and whatnot. The difference is their cases, as is, you know, Greta explained on her social media post, were relatively mild. She said that she's had colds that were kind of worse. She had some, you know, some shivers and chills and a cough and whatnot. But she also explained that her dad also had symptoms, and his were much more severe. So, you know, people have to remember, young people still can get it. And also there have been cases of younger people. So, you know, the bar in Sweden is, they're saying anyone over 70 is, they're recommending some social distancing. That is one method that they're taking to try to cut down. But in most places in the United States, we hear more like 60, anyone over 60. But it's also for people who have any kind of a pre-existing condition or other health or health issues that might make them more susceptible to getting sick. If the virus, you know, implants inside of your lungs and you already have some pre-existing condition, or you have some sort of immunity issues, you're a cancer survivor, you're going through any kind of cancer treatment, well, then no matter what your age, you're going to be more susceptible to this, to it getting worse and potentially being hospitalized and even worse.
Well, before we take a quick break, I bring you to the United Kingdom and I give you the Prime Minister.
I am working from home. I'm self-isolating, and that's entirely the right thing to do. But be in no doubt that I can continue, thanks to the wizardry of modern technology, to communicate with all my top team to lead the national fight back against coronavirus.
That, of course, is Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, tested positive for coronavirus. We'll talk more about the UK, Hayes Brown, but a lot of Brits, when they woke up to the news, must have been, you know, gotten a dose of reality to know that their own prime minister is now self-isolating in 10 Downing Street.
Right, not only self-isolating, but tested positive, which has got to be a shock for the people who just a few weeks ago were being told, keep shaking hands by the prime minister, who had until very recently resisted the calls to have people self-isolate. Now, granted, Johnson did take a very hard turn in recent days, and telling people to only leave their homes for four reasons. But for the British people, this has got to be like a real shock, especially considering the health minister also has tested positive for coronavirus now.
Now, Hayes Brown mentioned it. Go back online. You can see Boris Johnson just a few weeks ago himself telling people that he was still shaking hands and that he was proud of it. A little bit of receipts for Boris Johnson there. We wish him well. Some good news from the UK, about 600,000 Brits have signed up to join a volunteer army to help out their National Health Service. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is, especially the Brits have been extremely proud of their National Health Service during the last few weeks, and rightly so. They've been there's been just an outpouring of support for the NHS and the, you know, free healthcare system that they have in place. Now, will the NHS actually be able to hold up to coronavirus? That's yet to be determined, because, I mean, one of the things that we have to remember going back to Italy is that Northern Italy had been lauded for its hospital system before the coronavirus outbreak. So if the UK is able to actually, you know, keep that curve nice and flat, the NHS should be in a good position to actually accommodate this, you know, coming swell of coronavirus cases. But this, you know, volunteer army who will be turning out will probably have a lot of work on their hands.
Now, there was, by the way, you could have missed it, there was a G20 summit this week. Now, it didn't happen in person. No shoulder-to-shoulder world leader photo ops in a meeting hall somewhere in Helsinki or someone else. No, this one took place online and took place virtually as leaders got together to talk about world events. President Trump joined from the Situation Room. Here's what the president had to say later at a press conference.
There is a great uniformity, I think. It was a terrific meeting. Tremendous spirit among all of those countries. You had 20 countries plus the other people that I mentioned, and a tremendous spirit to get this over with.
That was the G20 summit that took place virtually that the president was talking about. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also led a G7 meeting on Wednesday. And Courtney, what happened with this meeting? There was some reporting that the countries in the G7 could not reach an agreement on a joint communique after their G7 meeting on coronavirus. Why not?
So it was largely because the U.S. Secretary Pompeo insisted on referring to coronavirus in the statement as the Wuhan virus. And the other nations reportedly thought that that was unnecessarily provocative, so they couldn't come to any kind of an agreement. I mean, it's you know, it's interesting. You know, we've all covered so many of these summits, G7, G20. And what's very clear is one of the most, if not really, the biggest benefits of the G20 summit are the meetings on the margins and the pull-asides meetings. So the one-on-one between the world leaders. That's where a lot of the agreements are made. That's where they sort of talk about the nitty-gritty of the issues. So both of these, the G7 and the G20 this week, the virtual ones, they really were intended to be more of a show of unity. But in the case of the G7 with the foreign ministers, in fact, it showed just the opposite. It showed this division over the other leaders were, you know, reportedly imploring Secretary Pompeo to say, look, let's all come together and keep this divisiveness off to the side. One thing that was really interesting out of the G20, I thought, was there were people who were there working from home, you know, so we got to see, you know, Justin Trudeau, he's sort of the most famous working dad in the world right now, probably sitting in his home office, conducting this, you know, international diplomacy.
Part of the question inevitably, Courtney, becomes, was the prime minister wearing pants? We will never know.
My, When my colleagues and I joke about that all the time. He did have a tie and a suit jacket on. It was one of the first things you look at is we're all working from home. We know the realities that you're not dressed up the way that you normally are when mm-hmm. you're sitting in the office.
Yeah. Well, he was wearing a tie. He was wearing a jacket, but I repeat what I said. Was he wearing pants?
It's the question of the week, Todd.
I want to make sure, as we get back down to business here, Vivian, I want to make sure we touch on Russia. Vladimir Putin has declared next week to be a paid holiday in an effort to keep Russians separated. Russia has announced it's closing its borders, canceling international flights. I don't know how good the information is that comes out of Russia now, but what do we know about spread there?
So that is a very legitimate point, Todd, about questioning also the transparency with Russia and the numbers that come out. But for the most part, Russia has managed to keep its numbers pretty low. And it's the reason for that is something that's been subject to a really fascinating debate over, you know, maybe Russia doesn't have the same kind of traffic back and forth over its border with China that, say, Europe has in terms of business and people going back and forth. And so maybe that's what contained it. Or maybe it's because of it doesn't have that sort of shoulder-to-shoulder condensed, dense populations in its cities the way that some of the European cities do. A number of different factors, but certainly there's a lot of concern that if this were to spread in Russia, its healthcare systems could very quickly become overwhelmed in the way that we've seen with Italy or other places. And again, you know, Vladimir Putin, just the way that he even gave his citizens a week off, calling it a national holiday, very much trying to paint this rosy picture of what's taking place. And he's not necessarily going to come out and give a worse, you know, a negative image of what's happening in his country or any indication that he might not be able to gain control over something like this, or that his government would somehow be failing to gain control over it. And so that's something definitely that you would have to question constantly. But so far, from what we know, Russia has it under control.
We talk so much about how different world leaders handle the imperatives of a pandemic, how they handle the optics, how they handle public communication. And in Brazil, President Jair Bolsonaro, he called self-isolation, quote, mass confinement. He said the virus was, quote, a little cold, just a little cold that you get. And Brazilians were not happy about what they heard from him. Listen. That is the sound of protest in Brazil, as Brazilians took to banging on pots and pans to protest what their president was saying about coronavirus. Hayes, give us a snapshot of Brazil right now.
Brazil is not doing great right now. They right now have the highest number of cases in Latin America with over 2,000. And yet Bolsonaro is still insisting that there's no need for federal action. So what you're hearing with the pots and pans banging, it's people in cities demanding that Bolsonaro's administration actually do something about this virus. But part of the reason why I feel like Bolsonaro is going all in on this being, you know, not true is same reason Trump did, the same reason Russia's Vladimir Putin has been trying to push down on the idea that things are going badly, because one, you want to seem like a strong leader, and strong leaders don't cow down to a virus, something that weaker people fall susceptible to. Two, you want the sort of nationalistic pride. Other countries are the ones who face these problems, not your country, where you are strong and where things are going well. That can't last forever. A virus doesn't care what your propaganda slogans are. And if people are dying, that's something that people take notice of. And really quickly, looping back to Russia, I have to point out that while Putin has been, you know, insisting that next week is a holiday, his spokesman had to come out today and say, actually, people, you need to still work here because people had been booking vacation trips to Sochi on the Black Sea, according to Bloomberg News. So they had to really shift and say, wait, don't. This isn't a holiday. You can't actually go anywhere. You need to stay put, please, people.
Holiday doesn't mean go have fun. It means stay at home, apparently. Russia will also have to get its messaging straight with its own people. Every country is dealing with a version of this. It's a question of how well they deal with it. We like to take a moment now at the end of the roundup to ask our reporter experts sort of how they've been thinking about the news stories that have caught their attention that maybe we've been missing, or how they've been approaching news of the pandemic from behind the headlines. Vivian, let me start with you. What have you been thinking about as you've been watching the news this week?
So my days are filled these lately with talking about the economy and how it's impacting, obviously, global economy. It's particularly in the last couple of days, looking at the U.S.-China relationship. You know, both myself and Courtney, we've talked about, you know, the messaging that's come out of this administration, calling it a Wuhan virus and everything like that. But don't forget, the Trump administration was also in the process of rolling out phase one of its very big trade deal with China. And this was something that was going to have a major implications for President Trump in his bid for re-election this year. A lot of that is now up in the air, whether or not they're going to be implementing these phases on time, whether or not it's going to even happen, whether China buys U.S. agriculture. All these, everything is now up in the air. A lot of the trade deals are up in the air. And so this is something that I'm really interested in focusing on in the coming days.
The impact on the world economy, which is now so stark, so impossible to ignore, something that was flagged for us many, many weeks ago, is people might have been watching the virus but weren't watching the dollars. And those two things are inextricably linked. Courtney Kuby, CNN, how about you? What's on your mind?
So, I mean, you know, I cover national security and military issues. So one big thing that we've been watching is just military readiness and sort of what are the larger national security implications for this? You know, in times of crisis, there's always a concern that some of the more rogue actors, some of the U.S. enemies might lash out. One that we've been watching is, you know, Iran, also North Korea. We don't have a good sense of the actual numbers of coronavirus in either of those countries, particularly North Korea. We know really nothing about whether they're suffering from anything in there. And how will those regimes potentially lash out? Another thing, I spent yesterday down in Norfolk covering the USNS Comfort. President Trump made a big pronouncement at his briefing at 5 p.m. last night or 5:30 saying that the Comfort was going to get underway. We actually had been down there reporting it all day. I guess he wasn't watching, but
no, that's a hospital ship.
Yeah, the hospital ship that's going to head up to New York City. And it was for the first time, you know, we all are so focused on our stories. I saw a very human side of coronavirus and its impact on military families yesterday. Just watching these sailors, there's 1,200 of them who boarded the ship yesterday. Many of them military personnel, saying goodbye to their families for a deployment. And they really don't know how long it's going to be. You know, moms, it's just heartbreaking to watch these moms saying goodbye to their little babies, and they don't know when they're going to see them again. And it's hard to look at it because we see military going on deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. But this is a very different battle that they're fighting here, these medical professionals, because they're going to New York City, but they're not going to be, they can't see their families. Mm. They're a drive away, but they won't be able to see them. They won't be able to, because they're going to be on these ships, they don't know for how long. And they also know that their families are kind of potentially fighting a war back home. What if their families get sick from coronavirus and they won't be there for them? So that was the first time that I saw, you know, I've covered a lot of troops departing and going on deployments, but that was one that really hit me yesterday to see and to watch these families not know when they were going to see their loved ones again.
The impact, the impact on our military families as they work on the front lines of the pandemic. Hayes Brown, take just a minute. How about you?
So I've been fascinated by the historical comparisons between what's happening here and what happened with other outbreaks throughout, you know, the last 100 or so years, from Spanish flu up until, you know, SARS to the H1N1 virus. And watching how this has been, you know, unable to be contained in the way that SARS was has been extremely enlightening, watching how the spread during the Spanish flu was all but forgotten. So what I'm looking at and what I'm most curious about as we move forward is how ahistorical this moment is and what societies around the world will look like once this is all said and done. Because no matter what, everyone within the United States, everyone within all the countries that are affected are having to take such drastic measures that the idea of what is normal and what is, you know, acceptable in terms of privacy, in terms of healthcare, in terms of government spending, it's going to shift within the next like year or two. So I'm really interested in seeing what that's going to look like once this is all said and done.
Yeah, the world will look different in terms of government spending, government surveillance, social norms, preparedness, social order, all of these things. This pandemic is going to change the world. I want to thank my guest. That was Hayes Brown, Deputy World News Editor at BuzzFeed. Hey, thank you, Hayes.
Thank you.
Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter for NBC. As always, Courtney, great to have you.
Stay healthy, Todd.
And Vivian Salama, correspondent with CNN. Vivian, great to have you. We appreciate
it. Thanks, Todd. Stay safe.
You know, ever since this crisis hit here in America, we've been asking for your moments of kindness from your community. Today's story is from Patrick in Opelika, Alabama.
Around town, we have some little stations that are called little public libraries, where they just are stocked with books for anyone to pick up and then replace. But lately, they've been all converted to little public pantries where we stock it with dry goods, food, snacks, drinks, whatever. And there's a sign there that says, take what you need and donate what you can. And, you know, folks donate and use food all throughout the day. So it's just been fantastic what we've been able to do as a community.
Yeah, just that little gesture in a community like Opelika, Alabama has to mean so much to the people who live there. We want your acts of kindness, your acts of solidarity that you've seen in your community. 855-236-1212. You can leave us a message on our free app, 1A Vox Pop. You can leave us a voicemail. Again, that number, 855-236-1212. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.